Welcome to the 71st episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. My name is Kalen Egan.
My name is Travis Sintel.
And my goodness.
We have the guests of a century here.
Guests of the millennium.
Wow, that's bold.
The millennium.
All right. Maybe.
Who are they, Travis?
These are some of my dearest friends in the world. We have Frances Callier and Angela V. Shelton, collectively known as Frangela. Hey. If you don't know them, sort it out.
Get your life together.
Yeah.
Get your life together.
Yeah, that's right. Where do I know you from?
You used to be really good at sound.
Yeah.
And
uh-huh. That's right.
Can I tell you guys something before you even introduce yourselves?
Yeah.
I was waiting to say this until we were actually started recording.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we set up this. We have more mics than usual, and we wanted to look more professional than usual. I have never seen Travis more nervous about people coming over. He was all worked up.
I was worked up.
He was pacing. He was eating bugles like a maniac. Couldn't wait to open the bugles bag because I think it's because they were coming over.
Well,
and he was like worried that you were lost.
Yeah.
He was so nervous about the whole thing.
Well, here's the thing. They have been gracious enough to have me on their radio spots before, and I was very appreciative. It was very fun.
We had a good time. They know.
But here's
dumb this show.
I know,
it's okay with them.
But I walked into their studio. They have a call screener. They have microphones. They have two people who run the stuff. They have a guy and another guy. I don't even know what the second guy does.
We don't either.
Okay. He sits in the back. I didn't know he was there until the end of the recording.
I know, they hide in that little corner.
It's weird. Yeah. But then they were coming over to Kalen's house, and I was like, let's have treats and let's have a fun time. And then, you know, and here we are.
And then as soon as they sat down, the sound crapped out.
Yeah,
and you were scrambling.
You were, right? Yeah, I was embarrassed. It was really embarrassing.
I really were. Because he met them as a sound man.
Yeah,
that's why it was so beautiful.
Well, let me tell you about our podcast, and then I'm just going to let you guys run for a second and talk about, you know, whatever. This is a podcast about nostalgia, where Kalen and I realized that
I'm not nervous.
I feel good. Do I look weird? Am I holding my body weird?
It's just a little microphone.
Is it?
It's
really tiny.
It's a mini microphone.
In my defense, a hard microphone to hold naturally.
You've gotten good at
it. It looks like something you've picked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a little dainty microphone flower that you picked.
It's like a nosegay,
yes,
people.
I'll stop clowning you. Okay, right, so keep going. Right. Please tell us about this wonderful, fabulous podcast.
It's a podcast where we just treat each other respectfully. And that's really the main ethos of the podcast. We try to really be kind to our own issues that we have respectively. So Kalen and I realized that some of the movies we watched as kids, 80s and 90s, were not good when we watched them as adults. But we were convinced that they were, in fact, good. And we decided to do a podcast where we went back and watched old movies to see if they actually sucked. I'm not going to mention Mike Garner.
No problem.
All right.
That's it. We just figured, you know, there are these movies that we held so cherished as kids. And everybody's got them. And movies you watched a dozen times and haven't watched in 20 years. And we thought, well, it would be a public service to go back and watch those movies again.
This is what we do.
And explore them and find out. And we pull them randomly, and every episode's a new thing and a new adventure and new discoveries.
Before we get into the movie, which I don't think necessarily suits the thing we just set up,
be
clear. So it's a left turn out of what we just promised you. All that said, it's not what we're doing today.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on that idea for a podcast?
I think it's a brilliant idea because, you know, one of the things you might know us from is Best Week Ever.
Yes.
And we are known as pop cultural queens or queens of pop culture. And we watch every movie.
Yeah.
And have since, I think, the day we came out the womb and being like, I want to see that film. So we, you know, looking back at those things, because you remember them differently.
Are there any movies that you remember watching as adults and being like, oh, I fucked this one up. This is not what I thought it was. Like for us, The Sandlot got us. A couple other ones. What was yours?
I've forgotten about that. The whole awfulness in Saturday Night Fever. Now, that's actually, I was a kid when that came up. So I saw it as a kid. I saw it on TV, I think. So some of it may have been edited. But you forget there's this horrible rape situation. Because I'm like, dance fever. You know, like, I'm doing my hand up and down. And then you're like, oh, wait, this is awful.
There's a lot of awful parts.
There's so many wrong things in it that you're like, why was this okay?
The 70s and 80s played fast and loose with rape and brown face and slurs. It's weird when you go, because you don't catch them as kids necessarily. You go back and you go, oh, this was a really dark thing, but this is not attached to the film. Some films escape that.
We found that watching Fame. You know, like Travis's favorite movies of Fame, and it was a cool movie. Actually, it was kind of a nice film. I liked it a lot. But it takes these hard, crazy turns into. There's another rape in that one, right?
We do Irene. There's rape in that. Irene Cara at that fake audition.
Yes. Which they act. That's the thing in the movie. She actually does, and it's like is so triply uncomfortable.
That's good. Just like that. So disturbing.
You guys can't.
Why aren't you dancing? Somebody dance.
You can't see her face, listeners, but it's a spot on Irene Cara.
It's spot on. Yeah. Spot
it's
on.
The most disturbing thing in the world.
And the movie, probably Saturday Night Fever has this too. They just don't. Then they just move on. And
No, nobody needs any therapy. Nobody needs to talk about it. No, we're going to go back on the dance floor. That's how we work out our problems.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Right. That's right. Makes a lot of sense. And Dirty Dancing. I mean, we all know that's actually a movie about abortion, as opposed to dancing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, there's both. There's dancing. Also,
I guess that's pretty dirty.
Is there an age issue? Because I believe that he is over 18 and she is under.
She's baby's 15 or 16 in that movie.
Yeah, it's like 40.
Yeah. But
that gets kind of like not dealt with.
I need to warn you. We have a couple heroes and villains on this podcast. Patrick Swayze is one of our heroes.
We love him. Yeah,
so I just want to say he's great.
Stop.
It's great.
Roadhouse.
Yes. So he did rape an underage girl, but it was the
Rape. Well, I guess it's.
Statutory. It's by definition.
You're right.
In a legal sense.
Legally speaking, he raped her. But it's also romantic because she liked it. Is that what we decided?
I mean, that's the kid. Do you guys have you seen Revenge of the Nerds lately?
No,
lately. I know it pretty well.
Look out!
I don't.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
I saw all of them.
I don't want to just. That's amazing, but I don't want to rehash all our old episodes. But do you remember? This is a horrible topic. It's just the rape runner through the '80s and nineties.
This is our intro.
But that's
I'm
how.
Sorry.
But that's how the nerd gets revenge. Is he rapes the guy's girlfriend?
Yeah.
But she likes it. She likes it because so that makes it not rape in the movie.
Dude, that's what happens in not 16.
I was gonna say 16. He gives her the girl.
He takes his drunk girlfriend and gives her to the guy, and he drives around, and then it does. They basically say that they had sex.
God.
She's so wasted. She's like, it's completely illegal.
I think about that all the time.
And she's in love with him. She's holding her ponytail, you know, because they cut it off. She got it cut off, and she's stuck in the door.
Yeah.
And they're in the car, and she's like, oh, did we do it? And she's like, I'm pretty sure we did. And then it's like,
I just want to say, I mean, current political climate aside, we've come pretty far in certain areas.
Yeah.
Like, we don't glorify nerd rape anymore, like, the same way we used to, I feel like. That's a step forward.
No.
And the good news is, again, for all this,
none of this
not going to happen.
Yeah, not
we got no rape. Absolutely no rape tonight.
Guaranteed.
Oh, good.
None whatsoever. I am 99% sure there's no rape.
No, I don't think there's rape. I haven't seen this movie in quite some time. We're going to lead into the film now.
God, what if there is?
I don't. I could say that. Oh, I'd feel really sad about this intro if there's rape in
Can I tell you, as a way of getting into what movie? They don't know. So you guys haven't. We have told you.
We have no idea.
This is utterly random, except it had a couple of things I thought would be interesting, especially to talk to you guys about. A, it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
B, the thing that we talked about the first time we ever met, insanely, is Steely Dan.
I love Steely Dan.
We're talking about Steely Dan. And Steely Dan once wrote an open letter to the director of this film and said, your movies have gotten worse and you need to go back to your good movies. So this is...
That's been on a tour bus too long.
Exactly.
On a tour bus too long.
But that's respect for the Dan, everybody. Respect the Dan.
You know what? I don't care if we are musicians. Somebody take this down.
And I always thought that was...
Get that girl.
And I always thought that was so funny.
Wait, honest question. Do you think it's just this director, or did he write a series of letters to other artists across America?
Yes, Steely Dan himself.
I'm assuming it's Donald Weber's name.
Both of them. They co-signed it. They both wrote it.
Where do they hide?
Of course.
That's why I said Donald, what's his face?
Because I can only see you. They have to be high in the back of the bus.
I don't like Steely Dan.
No, if we just tell Coppola, it sucks.
So this is that director's first film.
Mm.
You got any guesses, or should I give you more? More clues?
No. Okay, Steely Dan at Steely their Dan height loves... when somebody was going to listen to them.
Yes. Yeah. This, okay. Not, yeah, this is yeah. not them at their height. this is like 5 years ago.
They weren't writing letters at their height, I think. They were doing drugs and stuff.
Yeah. They just felt inspired to go tell him to get back comedy. To his roots.
They expected it to be good.
And so like they loved this film that we're right. going to watch.
I love and this film also. I kind of agree with Steely Dan.
I'm going to say comedy, Zemeckis.
Nope. No. I'll tell you what. I'll give you one more. It's okay. 90s. As opposed to 80s.
Okay.
I also just will say, as a broad hint, that this director tends to reuse the same actors.
This director is polarizing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I will say I agree with Steely Dan.
Is it Woody Allen?
I know you don't. And we kind of teased this last episode.
No, I would. Nobody would ever.
Much more Woody current. Allen. Much yeah. more contemporary.
Still producing films.
Oh,
still producing work.
No. No.
Comedy. He started his career in the 90s. Yeah. Started.
With this film, right?
With this film.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Valley Girl for some reason, but that's...
80s. 80s.
Yeah.
90s. Most recent movie came out 2 years ago?
Yeah.
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh.
Polarizing.
Maybe Oliver Stone?
Good no. idea earlier. I. What about this? That the stylized
for people who know what I the know. Movie is.
Stylized. Well, the title of the episode will be this movie, so it's boring for everybody. But stylized, super stylized visuals and comedy.
David Lynch. No.
Stylish. Comedy. Stylish. But comedy. This is a comedy. Straight comedy.
I'm trying to go comedy. Yeah.
But I would say he's not necessarily known as a comedy director.
Oh,
I would say.
Okay.
He's
so that's what I've been stuck on.
It's hard because I know what Kaylin's saying because it's not,
not
how you ask.
Indie, right? So we're not talking like Jim Jarmusch or something. Like
and
that.
We're not talking only... about Kevin Smith.
No, but it's later. But now you're in the right era. This just came just after that.
Yeah.
This guy likes to put stuff. Very balanced frames. Yeah, this
is oh, the you're one. Talking about Quentin Tarantino.
No.
But the balanced frames are good. Symmetrical frames is
and,
a good one.
And they're funnier than Tarantino. But symmetrical, he's got the same cast. No.
I'm gonna give some cast members now. Not in this film, but a regular cast appearance. Bill Murray.
Okay.
Now you know.
Oh, it's what's his face?
Yep, that's
who
the one.
Who did Rushmore?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Wes Anderson.
Yes.
Wes Anderson.
Oh my God. Okay.
That's
okay.
Who we're talking
you know,
about.
I'm so not even in the
Wes
wasn't even
Anderson.
In the room.
You know what?
That's so all I had to say.
It's hard because he's kind of a comedy director. This is a straight comedy for sure.
Is
but
this
also,
is not Bottle Rocket.
This
is
Bottle Rocket.
I've never seen it.
You haven't seen
yes.
Bottle Rocket?
No!
That's amazing.
You haven't
I
seen it.
I love this
That's
movie.
That's great.
Really
love
people, and people it's love it.
I love it. I love
That's
it.
Great
I, you
news.
Know what? I would disagree about this. His movie's getting worse issue thing, too.
Kaylin does, too.
We got to talk about it. That's going to be what, I mean, there's no way to do this show. The idea of the show is to look back at movies through the filter of time, and now he's had a much longer career, and we have a lot to say about that career, I think.
Yes.
And so we should use this movie as the root for that.
I agree.
I've seen
you know, it
every
is.
Other one of his films.
Are you serious?
Oh, this is a big day.
Wow.
I think we're doing a social service for you today.
You are. That's what's so funny. It's just like, oh, okay. And because I know it's the first film and because I've never seen it.
That's Perfect. Amazing.
I think this movie is so funny. I hope I still think it's funny.
The last time I watched
too.
It, I thought it was
I
so
hope
so
for
funny.
You all.
But here's what I wanted to say about Bottle Rocket. Yeah. Just as way of intro, we'll start watching the movie and we'll talk about it. It came out in this 90s period, like 95 or 96 or whatever. And I know I say this all the time on this show, the 90s are defined by Quentin Tarantino and probably the early 2000s. That's just, he's like the only guy that mattered, changed everything about filmmaking, changed everything about how the world interacted with American film. And so when Bottle Rocket came out, its tagline, like that they put, like the pull quote, always made me crazy because they called it Reservoir Geeks. And I'm like, that is so, it defines the era so specifically.
Yeah.
Because everything is in the shadow of Tarantino, but it has nothing to do with Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing.
And
that
for
that,
sure, Wes Anderson didn't like that tagline.
Oh, he must have fucking hated it.
Right?
Yeah.
For sure.
He must have hated it. Yeah. It's just so inappropriate. And, you know, but, you know, that was the time. And I also remember, I saw Rushmore before I saw this movie. I didn't see this when it came out. But he won. This was also the era where they were like giving awards to directors, also because of Tarantino. And so like MTV Movie Awards gave him Best New Director Award. And that's when that mattered. Like that meant something. And it was so funny. And I remember that very vividly. It's like, I guess that's a guy now. Yeah. MTV Movie Awards says so.
Yeah.
So therefore he's
a
guy.
He was a guy. You guys like his other movies? It sounds like
you
do.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, big fans.
Yeah.
Big fans.
So you don't.
No, I do. I just remember, and this is now I'm going to see if I still like this movie. I just remember having such a positive reaction to Bottle Rocket. I saw it two or three times when it first came out. I was like super into it. And then it was just, to me, a slightly stylistically, and to me, they kind of gradiated off for me over time. Because it became a stylistically different type of thing that I fell in love with.
The criticism of him is that he ceases to be he gets so micromanagey and fussy and I don't know, claustrophobic's the wrong word, but it's also just tightly controlled that it has no reality, has no air. And my sense, particularly with the last one, Grand Budapest Hotel, is that that's when he. That justified everything he was trying to do to me, because I think it's like maybe his best movie.
I didn't
see
it. And here's the thing. I really think that, like Francis, if I would have come to Wes Anderson in a different later film and had a different lens on what I thought he was wanting to be, I think I would have had a very different experience with him overall. Mm-hmm. I saw the first five films of his chronologically as they came out, and I was still holding on to the Bottle Rocket lens.
Yeah. Right.
And I think, I want to go back and see if this is true on this movie. I wonder if that just colored the sort of the tint of all the subsequent films.
Yeah.
Because it seems like he's refining a thing he's doing, which is not necessarily what I liked about Bottle Rocket, I think.
Well, let's go watch the movie and we'll talk about this on the other half. But something to think about as we watch it, I think, is putting that. There are a lot of directors where this happens, where they do something early on and they're still kind of figuring out how to make a movie and they're still sort of sorting out what their style is. Mm-hmm. And as they get more confident and they start to specify that style, I would even put Tarantino in the same category.
Yeah. Yes.
People start to, they start to think it's too manufactured, or they start to lose that sort of same feeling of, I don't know, investment or something. And Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, after that, people started to complain. They started to get like frustrated by him being too sharp. His thing was too sharp. And I think it's so interesting that certain directors refine that to the point where they like it and that's what they want to do, and people start to pull away because there's less room for them or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what that is.
There's also, I think there's a lack of sort of fairness or awareness around the issue of that first film. I know they paid for themselves, if I remember correctly. Like, it was a very, you know.
It's a weird story.
Yeah,
it's, you know,
I don't remember the whole thing at all. But
well,
like,
I can tell you real fast, because it's a good topic, is they did a short film.
Yeah.
James L. Brooks saw it,
right,
and he said, I will make that into a feature for you, with you. They didn't know how to do that. He brought them, he like put them up on a lot. He paid them all this money to develop it. They didn't know how to write a script, him and Owen Wilson. And he like just handheld them through the process of
it's
making a movie.
Mentoring.
Yes, which is gone,
something
man.
White
like,
men do for each other.
Well,
yes.
Not nobody does it anymore. I mean, nobody does that anymore. Like that.
Don't make it about that right now. We're not. This is
I'm
different.
Just saying.
That.
I mean, you told me the equivalent someplace else.
I wonder.
Hold on.
I'm just saying.
We're treading on ground again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can't help but go there.
Yeah. No, no, you should go there.
It's a hard weekend. Yeah.
Well, and we encourage that on our show. Yeah. What you watch on the day you watch it matters. And I mean, Bottle Rocket, again, is not going to have a whole lot to do with anything else that's going on, but it might make it hard to enjoy. I don't know. That kind of mentorship doesn't happen at all anymore. I mean, it's the industry doesn't, as far as I can tell, the industry doesn't allow for it. On any level with anybody. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
Well, the money isn't there.
There's no money. And that's why. There's no money to put toward independent filmmaking or low budget studio filmmaking.
No, they call Black Swan an independent
film. That's crazy.
Which I'm like, it's insane.
Yeah. A lot of movies that come out at $30 million that are independent films.
Yes. That's independent?
Yeah.
This movie could not be made right now. Probably, at least not in this way. Not with a studio financing it.
I
don't think he would make it this way. Like, I think if you think about Wes Anderson, if he redid Bottle Rocket, I don't think it'd be anything.
Completely
I'm excited
agree.
To see it again, because I think you'd be shocked at how different it would be.
Yeah.
I bet it's so loose. I think, well, for our podcast, it's our first Owen Wilson, but I think this is the first movie I saw Owen Wilson in.
Yeah. Mm.
Sure.
And I remember thinking, oh, that guy's awesome and so funny. And that loose style really sort of, I think generated a lot of the feel of the film more so than the direction did, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
The movie in my memory feels loose, and his later movies feel controlled to me.
Yeah.
And I like the looseness.
So controlled.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Like you go from a world that's actually a world you recognize to sets.
Yes.
That are very clearly sets, you know?
Yes. Or turning real world locations into set looking places, which is
like
a crazy thing.
Like it's sort of amazing how it's absolutely, I get and how you can get caught up in sort of the, like, I almost want to say, like, the set porn of it. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so, there's, like, what's the movie? She, the man, woman who movies, we like the houses, but not the movies.
Oh, Nora Ephron.
Right. Like, she makes house porn movies. Yeah, but, like, yes, the houses are amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I want that house so bad. But you don't really pay attention to a lot of what's going on in the movie, because it's, like, who cares?
Yeah.
But I'm like, did you see that garden?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Like, right, it's in between, gorgeous, the way that she redid that kitchen.
Oh, the hydrangeas.
Oh, gorgeous. I want that. I want that. Where'd you get that cutting board? So it's like, you don't even care. But I feel like that the difference between resources and information totally informed who Wes Anderson became, yeah, and after that.
Yeah.
And then the next slowest, least sort of like claustrophobic thing I would say is Rushmore. And then it's off to the races.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's not a piece of dust that isn't color coordinated.
You got it.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, which I really love about it, but I know that can be hard.
Yeah. It's weird thinking of a movie that has the memory of looseness and Owen Wilson-ness to me becomes a guy who is so tightly controlled, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of movies that are loose. I remember this one being like super loose in my
so
memory.
Have you kind of not seen Bottle Rocket since you've seen all the other Wes Anderson movies?
Correct.
So that's crazy.
Maybe that, since it came out. Like, I don't think I've seen it twice.
Oh, really? Oh, that's going to be fun. That's going to be interesting.
Not fully, at least.
We picked a good one.
Yeah.
It's going to be good.
Let's eat some Bugles, pop some popcorn, drink some Chardonnay, and watch Bottle Rocket.
Let's do this.
Wait.
Please don't interrupt me, man, because I'm trying to stay focused on this stuff. You're responsible for the external situation tomorrow. Streets and the getaway.
Whoa. Excuse me. Are the explosives really necessary here? I think it'd be a lot more simple if I just walk up to the door alone. I think that would be...
Why are you undermining me, man?
How much bullets does this thing take?
Bob, look, please, I'm paying attention.
God damn it! You're not paying attention if you're messing around with the gun. Now quit...
Anthony, just
keep the gun on the table. Keep
dignity, relax.
I can't focus unless the gun is on the table.
You just paid for it.
Shut up, man. Shut up. I'm warning you now. Be quiet, please.
It's true, Dignan. I paid for the gun.
Say it again. Say it one more time. Say it again. Repeat what you just said.
I paid for the gun.
He's out. You're out, too. And I don't
calm
think I'm
down,
in either. No
down.
Gang.
Francis, as someone who had never seen the film.
Enjoyed it greatly. Loved it. Saw Wes Anderson all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was reminded about being in the 90s.
Yes.
Me? I was placed mm-hmm. in the 90s.
I mean, when you throw a Proclaimers song on the soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
it is instantly transportive.
Even I mean, no cell phones. Like, and the like difficulty of finding somebody who you don't actually have any way to find. Like, now, he could go on Facebook
mm-hmm.
and probably... Right. Generally speaking, within 3 to 7 attempts, gets close to her, you know. But like the fact that's a whole—you're just calling random people.
There's a whole sequence of a landline travel, you know,
which is an awesome Wes Anderson sequence.
Yes.
It's really good.
It's beautiful.
What about you?
I fucking loved it. I loved it. I loved it, and it what strikes me, which didn't strike me the first couple times I watched it, being a young film viewer, is how extraordinarily simple. Sort of reductive this plot is. It's really mm-hmm. like a classic little plot that's just elevated by the direction, the timing, the little clever transitions in the acting. I think it's so fun.
When do you think it becomes a plot? Because I was watching the movie being sort of fascinated by like, whoa, when does this actually become a story? And it almost never does.
It almost never does, but I feel like it's hinting at a plot where you know there's going to be a big heist at the end. I think you sort of feel it coming.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I know. You know, I'll tell you when it becomes a plot.
Yeah.
When he strikes his face with the
screwdriver
or whatever.
Totally.
That's the moment it becomes real. And I literally said, this is the point where it's supposed to become ugly. And... 2 minutes later, it does, and that's when we are in the film.
You got it.
That's mm-hmm. when we have two, like, Full Metal Jacket. We have two halves of a film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's
right,
good.
Right,
yeah.
right.
That's Full Metal Jacket's a good reference.
I have to say, I feel like it starts at the beginning of the movie. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I believe standing there with his psychiatrist in the window where he and the psychiatrist agrees to it. And at first you're kind of like, why would he? And then he says, don't try to save everyone.
You know what's amazing about that line?
That is the log line of the film.
Do you know what's amazing about that? I submit to you that was an 80-yard line. I believe.
Oh yeah,
that
there's
was
a couple,
recorded.
There's another line.
There are a lot of.
There's a few lines like when I think Owen is talking.
where I'm like, and you don't see, I'm like, that's ADR.
When he turns his back, you hear it ADR.
Yeah, that's Luke. Like,
and
there's
I think
there's
that
a few
they,
places.
I think they did that for that exact reason. And watching it again, this many years later, whatever, I was like, oh yeah, they are telling you what the movie is.
Yes. This is the log. That's
but
the log
they,
line.
But they did that in retrospect. They were like, I mean, and yes, obviously that's what the film was. It's about his interaction or his friendship and, you know, fall. I mean, what I kept thinking watching this movie, especially in the context of Wes Anderson, is like what was amazing about it was this was a time where he, I don't know if I should psychoanalyze him like this, but like he didn't have the confidence to build a whole world, but he could build a character who created a world. And therefore, every time you wander around with Dignan,
you're in it.
He's in his own reality bubble. Yeah. I mean, he creates the world that he lives in.
That's an amazing character. Mm. And I have to say this, when you're looking at it, all films are made in post.
Mm-hmm.
But what you love about Wes Anderson is that he, as the director who is allowing the actors to do what they're doing in the moment, he allows the freedom, and when you're talking about the looseness earlier of this film, he allows them to be able to improvise. So much of that dialogue is improvised. It's not fully, yes, he has a plot and he has information that he wants people to get out, but it's so, the dialogue is so loose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would go beyond allows. I think he needs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this actually, when I haven't seen it, like I said, I think maybe since it came out.
Yeah.
And,
which is
maybe
which
bits
is
and pieces
21
here and there
years,
or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I look at that and I'm like, and I'm only 28. And I look at that and I'm like, I feel like he, this is where everybody's sort of on an equal plateau. Like, everybody's on the same level.
Mm-hmm.
You start to see those levels change. And then we get to Steve Zissou, you know, and what's the movie called? It's
Life Aquatic with Steve
Zissou. Yeah. When you get to that point, it's all about Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I feel like. That's the movie where it's like, it gets to me. But this is where it's still, like, they're like friends, right?
Yes.
They're all at the same level. So there's not,
they're working together.
To,
you can see.
And also they're new.
I feel that point, actually, a lot. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. That
Except, here's the thing, though. He's doing, his movies started to become huge extrapolations of his main characters.
Mm-hmm.
And in this film, you locate it at Owen Wilson's character.
Yeah.
He's the one who's creating the tone of the movie.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of him. And Luke Wilson's sort of caught up in it because he's this guy who can't say no to his friend, who's desperate to sort of give him the life that he so deeply desires.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the trap. And that's sort of the tragedy or narrative of the film. But every character's like that. He just started to locate them as bigger and bigger personalities. So Max Fisher in Rushmore, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He creates his reality, but you can still see that there's another reality
there's
past
empathy.
That.
And
there's
yet
empathy,
they all are Arrested Development.
Every single one.
Accepts each other at the end of the day. It's
beautiful.
Profoundly respectful.
Yeah.
It's like that everybody respects each other, even in like fucking each other over.
Yeah.
Like they're not even mad about Sonny stealing their shit. Cause they're like, you know, like it's cause it's just like, hey, like they're just, there's an acceptance. I do think it's one of those movies that you're like, I don't know. I didn't, you know what? That's not true. I did see the short, but I don't remember it.
Right.
I saw it at the DIA. They have a film in Detroit. And I remember thinking like, I don't know if I would have thought fund this movie from that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that I find really
interesting. Are all the actors in the short?
Yes. And here's what's weird about it. It's basically just the story through the book robbery.
So I think that's as far as I think it for him at that point it wasn't that's why I agree. I don't know, but I believe you on the like log line being added sort of after.
Yeah.
Because that's not in the short.
Well, you know what?
Loosely funny and wacky.
Yeah,
not,
and it's like it's only like 15 minutes long, it's black and white, it's truly independent. But what's with Wes Anderson, I gotta say, like, as much as I love him and I love his movies, and I think they're amazing, and watching this really put a lot of his career in relief for me in sort of locating it into the heads of a certain main character or whatever, which I think is consistent in every film, or roughly, even if it's a family like Royal Tenenbaums. But
no, he's got like this anti-hero that's very distinct.
But the thing I never understood about him, not that I didn't understand, I just don't relate to, is like the original Bottle Rocket short he filled with Peanuts music. It's all Vince Guaraldi.
Mm.
He is obsessed with Peanuts. And I'm just not a guy who ever like loved peanuts. Like,
well, see, this is the what you know what this is the problem.
Come on, now.
Snoopy
come
was my shit.
Let me clear. What is the deal with peanuts?
Let me be because it's evocative. It's evocative, and in the music. The Christmas music that he really keeps bringing in, it's very clear about, it is about this, what's the word I want to say?
Tradition?
Not just tradition, but this cleanliness of the moment.
Yes.
That music evokes.
Pure people.
Purity. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's a purity. That's what it does.
You don't judge, they're not bad people.
Yeah. Yes. No. Yes. But it's the same, I understand the correlation, I just don't. I feel alienated from it a little bit. It's just like, because
I
just never, I mean, I liked Peanuts. I watched the cartoons or whatever as a kid, but there's something about what he seems to understand or mine from that material. There's no parents. You're
How
in a constant state of adolescence.
Yes.
Like what is, well, now he's, I think when he made this, he's probably mid to late 20s.
So,
well, so at that point, like, we're the same. I'm the same age.
I totally get it because
so I get it.
I do think that there's something to the common cultural experience of certain things, which you guys are like a day or two younger than us, I think.
A hair.
And like maybe, like a minute. But like, did you guys see After School Specials and all that?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. But not
Travis
like,
more than me. But.
I'm a hair older than Cameron.
Our indoctrination for especially Generation X was completely and wholly all together. We weren't segmented yet.
You're right, actually. And the literary movement around this time has the same disassociation that Wes Anderson does.
Exactly.
Douglas Copeland does a lot of this stuff.
What does that mean? Writing. How do you define that disassociation?
So Douglas Copeland, for example, Generation X, you're not expected to relate to the characters. You're expected to relate to the things they say.
Exactly.
If that makes
referential
any sense.
Referential information and comedy is very big in the 90s.
Yeah,
and that's
the specific
door code,
period.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
this
yeah.
reference you're in.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of Generation X, you feel disassociated from Generation X reading it, but you feel connected to the ideas and material of it and the sort of concepts about what he's talking about. And a lot of this, I think, here is I am not necessarily identifying with any of the characters in this film, but I am enjoying them. And
I agree with that.
From the emotional impact of it.
Are you is that how you were supposed to relate to the? I mean, I don't know.
I think so. And I know for Douglas Copeland, you are supposed to do that for that book at least. And there's other writers in the time period doing the same thing. But that is really synchronized with the literary.
Well, here's the thing. What struck me more this time than any other time I've ever watched it is identification with Luke Wilson. I don't feel like I fall into people's delusion spirals or vortexes, but that's what he's doing. And I was like, I understand that feeling. I understand trying to make somebody's world work the way they say.
You know what I mean?
Your whole life? I mean, that seems to be.
But like, why am I here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm here for I'm here for people. Everything else is dust.
Yes.
You know, so like, why wouldn't you? This is your best friend.
Yes.
You know?
And I'm going to, I have planned a 75-year plan.
Yeah, dude,
I
put
myself.
They
well,
make it very clear
he
put himself in the mental hospital.
Yeah.
He didn't get sent there. He put himself there.
Right.
And that to me is that moment that if, here's the thing. I think like the, my critique outside of being of this era and all that stuff, if I were going to deconstruct this for like a thesis, I would get into class struggle. I would get into why these quite clearly upper middle class white people are so desperate for some sort of identity.
Well,
that they turn to ridiculous crime.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
no, I want to talk about it. I think we should talk about it.
Well, I think that's something I don't watch, but I'd be like, for me, like watching it, I like to watch. Here's the thing about being black. Which you probably know because you're very black.
Yeah, thank you for
it's
saying
that. It's a 24-hour-a-day job. Mm. And there are days, hours, minutes when you just want to be just like free of that job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to go to a movie and not have to worry about the only black character is the one who killed someone. Or,
right.
You know what I mean? But that's just not how we roll. Exactly. And what's wonderful about, for me, about most Wes Anderson movies, if you allow yourself to suspend your disbelief on a few things, especially as he gets further on in his films, it gets a little harder as it gets further on.
Yeah.
But if you do that, it's like Martha's Vineyard. It's this place that exists in time but outside of it, also culturally, where black people and white people and Asian people and Latino people, like, we're just people.
Yeah.
Mm. And there's something kind of beautiful about that. It's hard to express it.
Yeah.
And
well,
I don't think that's actually something he's trying to express.
In some ways,
but he does.
I wonder if it is. I really do.
Yeah.
Because he, especially as time goes on, and this doesn't always apply racially, but sometimes it does, is he puts people in situations that make no sense. Like, he'll say, like, There's a scene in Grand Budapest Hotel. Just Grand Budapest as a thing is fascinating because Harvey Keitel is playing fucking Harvey Keitel. He's got a ridiculous New York, Brooklyn guy accent, but he's in this European country and he's breaking out of jail. The characters take on personas. Like, the actors are themselves playing characters. Yes. That becomes very important. And they're all contributing to a fantasy. And so when he's very conscious, I think, about constructing false worlds and false realities and letting you know he knows that's fake.
Yes.
But isn't it beautiful that they're trying to create this alternate?
And this is what I will say, too, about every person of color that I've seen in his films, because that is one of the reasons why I've been drawn in over the years to all of his films. They always are the smartest people in the room.
And they're not like this. I'm going to tell you, for me, The Royal Tenenbaums, you can say a lot of things about that movie, but I love Danny Glover.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, he's an amazing actor and an amazing activist. Yes. He's someone I completely admire. And what I love about using Danny Glover in that role, and I don't know how that happened or whatever, but what I do know is that they do not shy away from the fact that he's black.
No.
Like, every single thing that fucking, what's his name?
Gene Hackman.
But it's, what's his character?
Royal Tenenbaum.
Royal. That's it. I was like, it's ridiculous. It's like, and black, actually. Yeah. Royal, that's black people. How many royal black people are there? I have a friend who both of her children are just as an honor.
I love that.
I'm just saying.
Just as an honor. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. And, but she married an Irish guy. Well, her name is Tina. So her name is Tina McNeil O'Brien. Black bitch from Detroit. But, like, isn't that amazing? But, like, in a cool way, I love that about how he doesn't, like, ignore it. It's not like he creates some sort of false world where this isn't important. Because every time Royal talks about him, he's calling him, like, Shaq.
Coltrane.
Yeah,
he comes at him.
Everything he says to him. But it's like, it's just sort of like this reality that doesn't get ignored, but we don't get mired in it.
Yeah.
And well, he's really using it that. When you watch that character do it in that movie, he's using it in, you know exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, it's his own personal insecurity.
And exactly. And he's incredibly jealous and he's incredibly vulnerable and he's trying to attack this guy. But, you know,
it's so feeble.
It's
like feeble.
And it's beautifully resolved with probably one of the best lines either Anderson or Wes or Owen Wilson's ever written, where Danny Glover says to him, you know, I don't think you're an asshole, Royal. You're just kind of a son of a bitch.
Exactly. It's like, a great line.
And that's the same thing. It's the same. It's like, we understand each other. We know what you're doing. And I kind of like you anyway.
Knowing somebody is my favorite line in any Wes Anderson movie is Luke Wilson's, I believe, improv line in Rushmore. When he's like, he comes to the play night opening the new public school, and he's in his scrubs, what's his name? Coppola, not Coppola.
Schwartzman.
Yeah. Is but Coppola is really pissed about it. Like, oh, you didn't change whatever. He's like, you know, I was in the OR, and he was like, or whatever. These like the OR, OR you,
oh,
or
are
like
they?
The yeah, OR. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's such a juvenile joke, but apparently that was he. That's his line.
Oh, really?
Luke said that line. Like, it wasn't in the script. He's like, like, he made that line up, and it's great.
Yeah.
Because it's perfect.
Can I ask you guys to do us a favor? Because we were egregiously far into this to not have done this, and I've been trying to find a way to
I forget get
this
every in. Time.
Let's just stop it here. Oh, no. I need you guys
Travis
to do
is the adult in the room.
I was just thinking, we always get feedback.
With the tiny
feedback.
Night.
We get blowback on Twitter for this. I would love if you guys could give us a quick plot synopsis so the listener understands what we're talking
about. All right.
Or as long as you like it to be, but like let's let the listener know what happened in this film, Bottle Rocket.
Okay. So, you want to start?
I would say we're best friends, Francis and I, in the ride or die kind of way.
Yeah.
And I think that Bottle Rocket is an exploration of what being a ride or die best friend is.
Oh, yeah.
And what you will do for your friend. And you notice that the family members, we really don't see that many of them. We see the bully.
Yeah.
But that's it. This is a movie, I think, about friendship.
About friendship.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And about what it means to be somebody's friends. And sometimes it means denying reality.
Yeah, if they need you to.
If they, yes.
And just waiting for them outside on visitor day. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is my friend. This is how we roll.
Yeah. So we open with somebody who has admitted themselves into a hospital.
But lies about it to his best friend so that he can have this whole little escape drama.
Yes.
Can I ask you a real fast question? Do you think he's admitted himself into that hospital to get away from him?
I think to get away from everything.
To get away from everything. I think that this is a person who was having a breakdown and and saw it.
Yeah, and but, in that upper middle class kind of way, like the parents leave a check on the counter and aren't there.
I just kind of,
that's where you get the feeling. Like, he goes to see his sister, who's, what is she, eight?
Yeah.
10
yeah,
years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's the person he goes to for advice, and he's all twisted up about. You never see parents.
No.
There are no technical adults. Yes, they're adults, but they're not adults.
It's peanuts.
That's
though.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you, the fact that the child, the 8-year-old or 10-year-old girl, mm-hmm. is the person he goes to for approval,
yeah.
tells me everything it's I amazing. Need to know, which is. The age difference tells his parents they can leave them alone.
Yes.
But really, they shouldn't, and they should give the credit card to the 8-year-old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, makes a lot more
what
sense.
What I love about it
well, it
is
equates them, makes them the same.
Exactly.
He's the same
and
as
the
8-year-old.
Like, her sigh is perfect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
What I love is that Owen Wilson has prepared for Luke a basically sixth grade outline
yes.
of the rest of his life. That to me is one of the most yeah. beautiful parts of that film.
Yeah.
Is looking, is the effort, is the, you know.
It's the believing that my friend must have been committed because he's not crazy.
No, yes.
he's
yeah.
my, like you could just, you could shove all the information in his face. He's like, no.
Mm-hmm.
But
and
he's
also,
trying.
And this movie is so fascinated. You're exactly right that it's about friendship. It's so it fascinated with the friendship that it you intentionally metatextualizes brotherhood
yes.
and reconceives it as friendship. Like
when his brother,
you
is
know
the
they're brothers. Yeah.
Exactly.
Like it's is it Plato? Or is it I think it's Plato who talks about friendship being the highest form of love.
Absolutely.
Mm. That you know, family can be a very confusing concept.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But people who choose to love each other in a way that does not involve sex, which complicates shit, it's unique. And that's what I for this movie for me, I'm like these are friends.
Yeah.
These are people who are best friends, ride yeah. or die best friends.
So yeah,
well, and, there's something beautiful about it.
And
yes, please.
I was going to say Luke Wilson is a bit of an intermediary between the
yes.
the real world and the fake world.
Yes. Exactly.
And, it,
right.
and he's the crazy
right.
one, allegedly.
That's
yeah.
why
that's, hit,
that's why it's his movie, and I think that speaks to the schizophrenia of this age, which again the books in this time period also do,
mm-hmm.
which is people caught between two opposing forces
yeah.
that don't know what to do,
yes.
and so they either segregate themselves from society and sort of ostracize themselves, or they just pick a side and go with it. And watching Luke Wilson sort of navigate a quote-unquote relationship,
yes.
which we'll get to in the synopsis,
right.
but also having Owen Wilson pull him into crazy town and having him not ever reject either of those,
don't
but just try to navigate
it.
It.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, he just you know, can't stand to see him his vision break for
yeah.
his fantasy for how the world should
because
work.
He wants two opposing things to exist simultaneously.
The
and
dark,
without Luke
we
Wilson,
do.
They don't, I don't think.
The dark side of this is American Psycho.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, Fight Club, too, does the same thing. It's
yeah,
segregation
Fight Club,
of
yes,
two personalities.
Okay,
but,
yes, yeah.
But Fight Club
yeah.
is righteous.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's given the devil horns, rock and roll symbol, everybody.
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay, so.
So, first right, scene down.
Yeah, we got it. All right.
so.
Onwards.
Yeah, yeah, onwards. And so, what we then see is this, the crazy leading the crazy
mm-hmm.
on
because
how to make
love.
Your life better.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm going
right.
to improve your life through crime.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a life improved through.
How many times did we see someone not do what Owen wanted, and then Owen apologizes.
Yes.
Every
like,
time, I think.
Every, I mean,
yeah.
there's got to be, because this is the thing, they don't do what they, in his, actually did ostensibly agree to,
mm-hmm.
and then he apologizes to them.
Yes.
That.
Every time.
Is fascinating. There's a brilliant and consistent pathology to the way
yes.
that he keeps his vision going by accepting the blame
yes.
or by sort of making it safe again. I mean, he picks fights with people.
He's a great manager.
And then immediately
yeah.
softens it by bringing them back in. He is a great manager.
He's a great
There's
manager.
A great moment
yeah.
that sets this up where he is chasing after Luke Wilson and he's like, come on, man, come on, come on. And then Luke Wilson says something that offends him. And Owen, who's
Stop.
Chasing him, stops, turns around and walks the other way. And Luke Wilson starts chasing him.
Yeah.
Yes. We all
yeah.
cracked up to him.
It's great,
it's
but it's so real.
Brilliant.
It's such a smart, like, grab, power grab.
Well, this
and
is
because
we all know these are moments where you'd be like, you know what?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
wait. No, I don't care. Yeah, we're being chased by the FBI. But that hurt my feelings,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and I want to talk about that.
Yeah. Or now, hey, you know what? I know I'm mad at you. You know you're mad at me, but right now I'm mad at you,
yes.
and you have to come apologize to me.
Well,
and that
to me,
working,
that is the
funny.
'90s was the your feelings can't be argued with decade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what is that?
Did
noise?
Something land?
That was a UFO. Don't worry about
That's
it.
That's my ride.
Yeah. Or die,
girl. I mean, just let me know. It was when because like the '80s were the. Was it
me
time?
Decade?
Yeah, and
yeah.
it was the
70s is me.
80s was the making time for your family. They called it
and
quality time.
Quality time.
Quality time. Yeah. And then the 90s
and 80s was also the yuppie.
Yeah. But like you got called. That was the '80s. Was when my mom made appointments for me to hang out with her.
Yeah.
You know. Are you serious? Because she was. Oh yeah.
From 2 to 4 on Thursday, we're gonna have time together. Was it like stuff you were gonna do knitting or something, or was it like
it was
we're
just
gonna
to
be together?
Spend time with her quality because time. That was she's quality. A single quality mom, time. And we were in Detroit. Yeah. And remember, quality time was a big issue. In fact, yeah. I wish I had it here. You've seen it, the Women of the '80s video. Mm-hmm. My mom's incredibly hot and kind of famous in Detroit. She was a city council member, ran for mayor and stuff. And so JCPenney did like this ad campaign about women of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And they picked local women for it. My mother's is amazing. My sister and I are in it, both at our most awkward phases, thankfully. I have something close to a mullet. It's really fucked up. But she's gorgeous. And I look back at that and I'm like, oh my God. The 80s were very me. The 90s were your feelings can't be wrong.
Right. Mm.
That's when you got into that whole, yeah. If I say my feelings are hurt, everything stops, yes. And we talk
about
your feelings.
Well, that's why the culture got schizophrenic. It's because feelings are inherently subjective, which means everybody's got their own view of reality at
exactly.
that point.
Exactly.
And I will give you another aspect of it. It is the first time that we were introduced to the concept of political correctness in the 90s. Uh-huh. And in fact,
contrary to what I believe people say. But
yeah. At Second City, there were tons and tons of scenes about political correctness.
They weren't even clever.
In college and, you know, in various situations and what have you. So you had a lot of political correctness scenes that, to me, was about the zeitgeist of society.
Yeah. That's
like
what it
first
was.
First steps into
that's
empathy on a larger level.
Well, that's all about identity. That's what that
is.
It's about who am I and who are you in relation to me and how do I make that make sense. Exactly. And that's an exploration of reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why you feel this distancing effect this 3 or 4 year period in movies and in books. Mm-hmm. It feels like we're all just trying to make sense of each other as independent beings as a culture.
We've been watching a lot of movies that come from the 90s, and this reminded me of Office Space.
I was about to say Office Space.
I love Office Space.
What is
I've seen that like 30 times.
What is Clock Watchers?
Clock Watchers is probably right here, right?
Yeah.
96,
that's
97,
what I think
95.
So too. Same thing.
And Fight Club and everything. But there's so much content here, which is, and American Psycho is part of the same thing, even though it's about the 80s, but it's made in the 90s, is this sort of sense of disassociation. And we talked a lot about Generation X.
Yes.
And that being how they were kind of defined in the culture. But like we watched Office Space, mm-hmm. and we were like, where are these guys at now? Mm-hmm. Like if they lived a life after that story, they haven't gotten anywhere.
No,
and
right.
We watched this movie and I feel the exact same way. This movie already knows that these guys are never going to get anywhere.
Let me tell you something. When I, in the 90s, what I was told was you will be the servants. Generation X, your life
You're
will be a life of servitors.
Really?
You will be servicing
people
older than you or people younger than you.
We were told
you.
For the minute we could
say
the words that we weren't going to get Social Security.
Yes.
My entire childhood, I was told, you will not have Social Security. You will not have these entitlements.
Yep, that's right.
Start saving for your fucking retirement.
When did that start? That started at what age?
Consciously, I would say, in elementary school even. Like, eighth or...
Wow.
Really did. They've been hammering home this, there will be no money for you.
Yeah.
Now, they haven't done it since, unfortunately, for the people behind us in some ways. But, I grew up...
Why we have this... That's why Generation X is who Generation X is. Because we were a very small generation.
Yeah.
We're just not a lot of us.
Well, that's because the abortion became legal.
Yeah. There's not a lot of us.
Right.
I mean, I can tell you, my mother has six brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And I remember we were talking one day, and I was like, oh, yeah, when was Roe v. Wade? And she's like, I can tell you exactly. Because it was the last baby my mother had.
Wow.
Because she had no ability to deal with it to do anything to stop a pregnancy before that. And so my aunt, she's 10 years older than me. And that is when abortion became legal.
Again, that's identity too in a community, in a country. Like I realize coming out of grad school, I was obsessed with Generation X, the book,
mm-hmm.
and then the literary movement spawned, and that's I mean, you can't take that without Fight Club or Trainspotting or all those books,
right, exactly.
Larry Brown and all these guys. So I really was obsessed with this, but I didn't know why. I just felt disassociated myself,
mm-hmm.
as I was told two separate things by society. Being a male from the South, mm-hmm. I was told this one thing, and then you go somewhere else, you're told, oh no, being a man's not that, being a man is this.
Yes.
But I think that, but women were told similar things, and I think as a culture we're told certain things, none of which made sense to any of us, because mm-hmm. none of it connected or made sense. Yeah. Yeah, but Luke Wilson, I think, is this guy trying to make sense of things that cannot make sense together.
Yeah.
They don't make sense together. And that feeling of like disassociation or pulling back and looking at that is pleasurable when you put it in a comedy, mm-hmm. and it's terrifying when you put it in American Psycho.
Exactly.
It's the same idea in certain ways. That's but interesting.
That's what I love about Bottle Rocket. Although I would love to know if there's a journal or a book about the making of it, because the, like a lot of his films, he doesn't have quick cuts in his films, usually, Wes Anderson,
right.
Or at all, I should say. Except here, there's that you get through the first beginning, there's a lot of, like, when he does quick cuts in Rushmore, they're plateaus. They're, pictures. They're, what's the word I want?
Tableaus?
Tableaus, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
They're tableaus. People are all poised, but they're not an active thing. Like, the cutting to the crazy party and the, like,
yeah.
all of that, that's really not him. He doesn't do quick one joke, yeah. like, bam, yeah. moments, yeah. or at least given who he is now.
Yeah.
But I just, for me, I think about people like, we talk about this all the time, like Billy Joel or John Mellencamp, mm-hmm. and how like they hate their early music.
That makes total
sense. Like John
sense.
Mellencamp, he did this amazing album like 3 or 4 years ago where he recorded in all these little small studios all around the country. It's a fucking brilliant album. But when he was promoting it, of course, people ask mm-hmm. him about his career and all that. And they ask about Jack and Diane and all those favorites from the 80s or whatever. He's like, yeah, I listen to that music now and I hate it.
Wow.
Yeah, I was so
I
bad.
Love that he said that.
I was so bad then.
And then I was talking about this in the intro a little bit, which is that I think this is typical of directors with really specific visions, mm-hmm. is that as they crystallize, as they find the powers to do it, they get embarrassed. I would say about this movie, though, it's so much more telling. I mean, I hope Wes Anderson doesn't hate it, but if he does,
I haven't heard it yet.
I would suggest to him, you know, it's
tell him, Kaelin.
It's exactly... It's more telling and more revealing. Perhaps that's the scary part, is that it's almost
too
personal.
Oh, yeah,
because
he gets tight-fisted controlled after this. I mean, but, let me tell you something. I'm going back to Steely Dan.
Yeah. Okay, finally we're back.
And their feelings about, you know, him. I'm going to say...
They wrote a letter about this movie?
When did the letter come?
They wrote a letter about the career. So they wrote it after... I want to say they wrote it after, like, Darjeeling Limited. And they were like...
Yeah, I understand that.
That was a hard
pill. That was a hot mess. That was a hot mess. You know what? We gotta grant every artist a Godfather 3, an Alien, Rocky 4.
But wait a minute.
We gotta grant them all that.
I love that movie, I thought about that movie watching this movie, because it's this movie has a really fascinating and awkward and interesting relationship to a minority culture. He goes and he tries to rescue this Paraguayan woman who happens to be a employee at a motel, and she eventually asserts herself. And what you feel coming in this movie, at least for me, and I was worried early on. I was like, oh man, like I forgot about this part.
Right.
But she becomes a person, and eventually she kind of abandons
that. She is a
person. Yeah, she is. She reveals herself to be a person.
Yeah.
And eventually she kind of abandons that. But then in Darjeeling, they never have that point of awareness about the culture they're in.
Yeah.
They're
like
existing
it.
In a world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
these guys don't live
world.
In it.
My favorite line about her is that she is a serious person.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's like she doesn't become a person. She is a person.
Well, that's...
Just because you don't understand
it's
her.
It's to him.
You don't know her. You don't know her. She is a person.
I find it intriguing that you could grow up in that environment and not speak any Spanish.
Yeah.
Like, it's... If this is Texas...
Yeah.
Like it's one of those things where like I took French most of my life and like 1 year of Spanish, and I could fairly decently translate most of the Spanish, not perfectly, but I was like,
yeah,
she's
me
saying
too.
Something about whatever, you know.
Well, like, the movie does toy with reality when it suits its purposes. Like it's a comedic effect he's going for. He's like, well, I'm not gonna do this.
It does, but it does. I watched it and I thought, oh, these guys are excluded from reality. They have excluded themselves.
Exactly.
Based on,
Haiti.
And that,
like
no, exactly.
At all.
And it's and when I say discovers, she becomes. I mean, the movie allows you to realize it as if you're stuck in their point of view, mm-hmm. and then you're like, oh shit, like their point of view is extraordinarily limited.
Yes. Yeah.
And
they're arrested.
And in Darjeeling Limited, they go to a whole other country and never recognize other people.
Yeah.
And that's
true.
I think that's intentional, or at least part of it.
Well, I think it's partly intentional, but I don't know if it is actually. I think Wes Anderson, I'm not sure. I look at all of his work, and that's all I have to go on. I haven't seen him interviewed ever. I've maybe read like one quote like 20 years ago. But what I can say is, for me, when I look at these movies, what I see is that one aspect of it that we are going to react to is that as minorities, as black women, as black people, as women, black women, because there's, you know, I can't separate those things, mm-hmm. contrary to what the Democratic Party might think. like that, I look at this, and what you realize is we have a terrific education in white people, but white people have no education in us.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting, like, one of the things I would like to push for is that Black History Month isn't for black people. It's for white people. It's for white people to learn some motherfucking history that of their own country.
Yeah.
That we
Your
know
own
it.
History. Absolutely. It's not black history.
No, yeah.
we know history. Yeah.
We
Absolutely.
Were in a meeting very recently where there were these two black people who were brother and sisters, it turned out. And they're from Albion, Michigan, which is crazy because they're Albion.
And this is at Viacom.
Okay.
And
they're high up.
They're
Should
high
we bleep
up
this? Are we cool?
That doesn't right. work well for us generally. Yeah. So for a lot of reasons, they're too complex for this. But this moment. But we had this moment where it was just Francis and I kind of, although there's all these other white people in the room, talking
Lots
to those
Lots of executives.
People.
Right.
And we were talking about how part of we were pitching an idea, and part of this idea, the idea is about cultural exploration awareness in a funny way, a very funny way, if I may say. And they were reacting, and we talked, and what for however we came about it, we were like, you know, like most white people don't know there's a black national anthem, and all the white people in the room went.
What?
Including people with us. What are you talking about? We're like the Black National Anthem.
And then all four of us started singing.
I don't.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. And all the
you
white people.
Know, have you heard it?
No. Do you know it? I don't know
don't.
It either. Don't
all
never
the
heard
white
it.
People were like, what?
And they were like, they were like, on their face were like
ours right now.
Like, riot in the room right there. We're like, wait a minute, there's something we don't know about you. There's a black national anthem.
The person with one of the higher people who I really do love and respect with us goes, well, I mean, I didn't vote on that. I go, did you vote on the first one? Did you vote on
You're
the
right.
American
yeah.
one? Yeah. No, you didn't. I was like, but when you were a black kid, especially a black lower to upper middle class black kid, first things you get when you're a child is a lifetime membership to the NAACP, and somebody gives you a poster or a pillow or something with that song quilted the fuck on it.
Wow.
And but white people don't, like, this is the problem. Like, for us, that's why I love his minority characters, even though ethnic minority characters, even though they don't necessarily have big plot points. There's something about the way he handles them that acknowledges that he doesn't.
It's beautiful.
It's ignorance.
That's right. That's right.
It's
real. It's real.
There's a line in the film.
Respect that.
There's a line in the film which is funny, but it's also. I mean, Travis and I talk a lot about honesty in films and in filmmaking, and people who can project something true, whether it's appropriate or not, or right or not, or progressive or not. And in this, the character has a line. Where he says, like, you know, I never learned a foreign language in school, and I feel that's really been a disservice in my life or whatever. I encourage you to do that. Something about the Generation X feels like they were told something about the country that they very quickly realized was not true.
Exactly.
And it comes out of the Wall Street generation or whatever. Yeah. Like
almost every major book in the 90s had this subplot.
And I feel like these characters are locked in a fantasy where they realize everything that they were told is bullshit. And so it's fascinating that in this movie they're instant alternative is crime.
Well, you know what's it's interesting about that to me is, like, this is obvious, but the most poignant, I think greatest image of a white male that I've seen in a long time is Owen Wilson has all these plans. He talks, he tries to take control of the situation, he makes noise, he runs around, and then Luke Wilson finds a woman and goes off. And what does Owen Wilson do? He goes and shoots off joyless fireworks.
Yeah.
It's noise and it's fury
he
and
literally it's, aims them at the ground.
Yeah,
he
it's
fires
but
them at the ground.
Not even at the sky.
It's joyless.
Fireworks. Joy out
it's
of it.
Yeah. It's joyless. It's fire and fury because he doesn't know how else to make noise or make sounds or to make visuals because it doesn't matter.
He doesn't know how to connect.
But what he's been doing is firing fireworks in the ground the whole movie, right?
Well, and
I was like, oh, I get that image. I know what that's like.
From the moment you hear about him, he is operating under false assumptions and lies.
Well, and if I can tell you a story, is that I remember this from the aforementioned MTV Movie Awards, yeah. where when Wes Kaelin Anderson talked about nerd. This film,
now we have to go look
I remember it. It really stuck yeah. with me for some reason. Yeah. And I hadn't even seen the film when I saw him do this little speech. But he said he just called it Bottle Rocket. He didn't know. He was like, that sounds like mm-hmm. a cool title, basically. And then he says somebody told him after that what a bottle rocket was. And they mm-hmm. said it's
he
a...
Never had one?
He didn't know why it was called. He didn't know why it was appropriate. And the person said, "Well, bottle rocket's like a little fucking dumb rocket that shoots along the ground and never gets up and never accomplishes anything, and it's always deeply disappointing." And he was like, "Oh, well, that's a perfect title."
Yeah, yeah, that works.
So I was like, "Good thing I nailed that title."
Yeah,
but it really stuck with me because now I watch it now, and that definition is still in my head, where I don't think of them as victims necessarily, but they just got. Sold a bunch of bullshit.
And to your point,
they would be, perhaps.
It's the experience of Luke Wilson trading one jumpsuit for another.
Exactly,
one uniform that's for good. Another. It's all the same.
Yeah, it's all the same.
Absolutely,
it's all the
same. But he is better for the experience. You inherently believe in the weirdest way. Yeah. We all know prison does not rehabilitate anyone. For it is for him.
I
think that in that last moment, so at the end of the film.
Well, we haven't even got to the second scene yet.
So basically, these two friends they get involved.
How long is this?
This is what happens. We always get banged up, and the fans get upset.
These two friends, they pull a series of heists. There's a whole plan to hook up with a criminal crew.
These are the worst
heists
ever, though. Cold
They're terrible.
They're
like,
so
a bookstore and cold storage.
Stealing from your mama. Steal from your mama's house.
What's worse is they put the shit back.
Steal it and put the shit back.
So these pathetic heists that never really amount to anything. They're just trying to lash out, trying to get a little bit of
They go on the lam the because dream. They have to let the heat blow off after the bookstore heist, and they end up in a motel, which is where
it kind of doesn't matter. The movie's just about these two friends who are kind of skittering along the ground and basically on the verge of realizing that nothing that they... that none of their ambitions will ever come true. Mm-hmm. And so all of it leads to Owen Wilson, who is the quote-unquote mastermind of all this fantasy...
Self-described.
Self-destruction, whatever. He winds up in jail. He gets caught. He kind of lets himself get caught. Yes. He kind of runs into a situation where he knows he'll get caught.
He sacrifices himself. He doesn't just let himself...
That's right.
He sacrifices himself.
That's important.
Exactly.
Yeah. In a getaway, that's a really long conversation.
That's
Dragon huge. Finnegan's Wake in a getaway.
That's right.
It's a big deal, though, that he does sacrifice himself.
But it's the first moment of human clarity.
It makes me like
it. It's also one of the first gestures he makes of friendship towards Luke. Wilson, it's been the opposite the whole movie.
And the way he puts it is, give me this one. Let me do this. Let me do that. And
you don't be it. I'm going to rescue us, not you.
Yeah. But what you say is very, very correct, which is that he trades in this goofy yellow jumpsuit for a white prison jumpsuit. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it's very rare for a Wes Anderson movie to get this kind of suddenly melancholic. I mean, all his movies are melancholic, but here in the ending, it suddenly becomes more self-aware and the bubble breaks. And I'm going to draw this back to Grand Budapest again. But like, he looks back and you realize he knows this is his whole life, that he's going to be trading jumpsuit after jumpsuit and he's going to wind up in prison or going nowhere. I mean, that's the end of him.
Mm-hmm. You know,
he knows that.
I have to say this, you know, compare this to an Easy Rider, to the young man of the same age getting back from the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. knowing that his Rebel country, that he's done these things for his country and what have you. But when you go back to what we're saying in the 90s, that men have been, I don't want to say the word devalued, but
a generation of men raised by women.
Yes, and they've been going down to this level of which grown men who are 26 years old, back in the Vietnam War, you're 26, you're coming back from war.
Yeah.
In this, you're still cutting lawns.
Mm-hmm.
You're still delivering newspapers.
It was kids' jobs.
That's really good, actually. Cutting lawns
and
newspapers.
Yes.
That's good. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, right?
Well, it's the same thing, though, is that when you – here's the thing about war, and this is what the post-war films were about, was when you come back from war, you have a self-definition. I'm a soldier. Mm-hmm. I have a job. I have a detail. I know what I'm doing. I've
seen some shit.
I come back. None of that matters, and I don't have a definition anymore.
Yeah.
And I
think that the 90s were that for, you know, guys or whatever. This is the idea of it, is that we were told we're certain things for forever. And the 90s are like, oh, you're not that thing, actually.
Yeah.
And I think this is what happens to these guys. Without they the get war. Scattered. Yeah, exactly.
Without
it's,
the
exactly.
experience, the man-making experience
so,
of war.
Yeah,
so they made the
right.
war,
that's
everybody
right.
gets a trophy in soccer.
Yeah.
They made the war.
Yeah,
and
right.
Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
well,
like suddenly
and then what
everybody is precious.
Travis said during our, I think during our Office Space conversation, which was very similar in terms of, you know, where white American men were at this sort of moment in time. He said, what's fascinating is that generation, even that evolution got arrested because 9/11 happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And suddenly there was a cause and they weren't included.
Yes.
And it wasn't a part of their fight. And that story never ended in a way that was natural. It got mm-hmm. hijacked.
Well, the war
so
is still going on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They discovered there was something
like
else.
But near dealing with 9/11.
But
no,
it wasn't
that's
a
what I'm
clear,
saying.
Because
yeah.
also it wasn't a clear war. It was a
no,
slide
I mean.
Into a thing, right?
That's what I mean.
And I think that I am interested by this generation because it was my favorite sort of generation to think about because I'm sort of just on the cusp of – I was looking ahead at it when I was a kid, a young man being like, oh, what's it like to be a grown-up? Oh, it's like these guys. Oh, shit. We're all in trouble, right? And so you look at these guys and they don't go – 9/11 chops it off of the head.
But I would look
never
at –
never manifests.
I look
it never
at Office
becomes
Space, I look at this movie, and I think these guys thought they were doomed – anyway, they thought
yeah,
that this
right.
was a dead end no matter
it's,
what.
It's a suburban cul-de-sac. Like, everything is a cul-de-sac
yeah.
of intellectualism.
Yeah.
That's
there's
right.
just, you're just like the Ouroboros.
Oh. Ouroboros. Yeah.
That's
snake eating its
problem.
Tail.
I have a problem with names. That is like, I always have to hit Francis.
Yeah.
Like, Ouroboros. But it is, I think the, what I've, where we're at right now is I think we're on the cusp of something really amazing,
yeah.
which is people understanding that the identity that needs to be actually explored is the dominant identity.
Yeah.
It's not for all my life. It's been black people this or men, and it's like, no, we need to talk about what it means to be white. We need to talk about what it means to be a white male. And what I love about Wes Anderson, and I do adore his movies. I really do in a way that I can't. It's hard for me to express. I did not Budapest. It challenged me.
Can I push you? Keep going, please. But I want to level a theory at you that
go ahead,
ties
to
Bottle Rocket. Well, I was just going to say that to me, the thing that makes me Budapest makes me cry, and
yeah.
the reason it makes me cry is not because I identify with the character, but because at a certain point, just like this film, you like. Do you remember the movie? It gets all the way to essentially the ending, and then it suddenly cuts to this black and white sequence, which is a repeat of a scene where he's on a train
mm-hmm.
and he's going to die, and the suddenly becomes almost Schindler's List-esque.
Yeah.
It becomes very stark, and everything has been very candy colored. It's all been about confection.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been about creating a fantasy world in the midst of World War II, with the encroachment of fascism and Nazism. And suddenly it becomes black and white and it becomes very stark. And he walks to his death.
Yeah.
And then the characters sort of reflect on what he was trying to do, which is retain a fantasy reality in the face of atrocity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also a denial of reality.
I'm going to watch every movie with UK.
but in that, and so I saw this film and I thought something similar, which is it's far less stark. It's not put in the context of World War II or whatever, where millions were being slaughtered, but it's the same expression, which
exactly.
is.
Exactly. He finds a woman who they don't speak the same language, and somehow they love each other within, 6 hours?
Right.
Like, and I'm not, I believe the movie sets you up to not want to deny the reality of that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, you know.
Well, he's.
We believe in, we're going to be in the moment.
Right.
We went to Mardi Gras, we showed our titties.
Yeah.
We are
you
winning
gonna see
Rome me. Bitches. We are winning Rome bitches.
But that's.
We will do what's required. I gathered my
Travis,
beats.
Put down that nosegay and look. Use your eyes.
Yeah, no one's made eye contact with me this whole podcast. It's been very awkward. Everyone's looking at the
right
wall.
Now,
it's weird.
Like, I hear a harpsichord whenever I look at you. It's really weird.
Yeah.
But, like, that's, I think it's really significant that, you know, common ground is. We all try to act like we don't have it, but we do.
Well,
like,
and
everybody
the,
knows what it feels like. You see her joy. Like, everybody,
everybody
what it feels
knows
like to love someone and have to somebody
well,
see it.
And what, how, and what it feels like to try to construct the reality you want to live in.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, bringing this.
With
the,
nothing.
With,
like they, I feel like they have, with all these privileges, they have nothing to construct.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
I have
sure.
to say
that's
that,
right.
Oh,
yes.
Please, go ahead.
No, she, you, that she said it so much better than I could. I was going to try to reiterate
that's true,
it. But,
I did.
This
is what is beautiful about Wes Anderson films, and what's beautiful from watching, now having the opportunity to see the first one. It is that energy, that joy and energy of belief and structure
yeah.
as a as a third grader. Mm-hmm. Oh, even younger, maybe even first or second grader, yeah. that I can construct my world, that I can construct my worldview. And that is what's beautiful about Owen Wilson, is that this is a character. And maybe in this way, there is something to be jealous about Arrested Development.
Yeah, there's no cynicism. Yeah.
You know what this is really? So right now I'm rereading all of Kurt Vonnegut chronologically is the project I've put myself through. Yeah. Kurt Vonnegut and Wes Anderson are extraordinarily similar in terms of the way they construct things, in terms of the way they write, and the disassociative character of characters, and the childlikeness of the of their characters. I mean, you can name the first four books from Mother Night, Cat's Cradle does it, Paul Proteus in Player Piano. They're all childlike. They're all infantile, and they don't understand why people are so mean to each other.
Well,
so
which is also a Salinger thing, which is what he pulls very distinctly from Salinger, which is like them trying very desperately to construct themselves away from depression and suicide.
Right. And what he does in Sirens of Titan is he's wrestling with this issue we're talking about right now, which is why can't people sort of sort out that they're humans first and all this other thing second. And so he has a character who fakes an invasion from Mars so that people realize that they're all human Earthlings first,
then
external enemy, you know, and they sort of do that. But watching throughout his books try to figure out a way into just secular humanism and finding a good image for it, it's not dissimilar from this stuff, and it does not dissimilar to the way it makes you feel. It's a weird hybrid of intellectualizing things, but you also feel it in your gut in a way that you can't quite put your finger on why you do.
This is what we do. This is the thing about what Francis and I do. Like, there's this concept in our legal system. It's called the character witness. Mm-hmm. Character witness doesn't have to have been at the crime, know anything about the crime, but you can call a character witness to say, Francis is not the kind of bitch that would burn 30 toddlers because one of them burped.
No.
You know what I mean?
I'm not
like,
that bitch.
If two of them burped, maybe, but not one. She would issue a warning. You know, like, so, but we have this concept of people can vouch for you, and which is actually not, has nothing to do with evidence or facts. It's just feelings. And I truly believe that we don't know what we're capable. I believe anybody's capable of anything in certain parameters, you know. But I look at the world and I think what's great about anything that, what makes me sad, I'll say this, the sad part of what we're talking about is that I feel that so much of Wes Anderson's movies are so, and I'll put it in the simplest, darkest terms, white.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That we don't get to have this kind of conversation on other levels about it, which would be really productive.
Well, and I don't want to like overextend this conversation into our present day in a deeply unpleasant way, but suddenly have is a next generation after this of white men who have gone straight up Nazi. I mean, they've gone straight horror show, and it's that they, I don't know what I deeply don't identify with, nor do I understand it. But I see something as a hyper extrapolation of something that's here.
That's right. Well, no, that's right. Well, I want to grant that I probably don't understand it the way that Francis does. But
Angela doesn't.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, Francis understands.
Travis is having a more connected time with this.
Yeah.
I do think that it is an identity, and it's much easier to identify as a person who is being oppressed than a person who is an oppressor or coming from a position of privilege, because you can excuse your own failures. And I think that there is people who've been given a lot of things, and someone's told to them, you're a victim here.
Yeah.
And you're not a failure because you're bad with women or because you're bad at school or because you don't have a job or because you don't have your own place to live. You are a victim because people have stolen things from you that you deserve.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
And I understand that as an identity, because then you have something to fight against.
And I'll go one further than you. This is the thing. When you are born, I believe, just in terms of the society, when you're born a white male in this country, you are told there has been a birthright for you.
Yeah.
There's been a promise made to you that is unspoken. It doesn't mean that your parents told you this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you grow up in this society, you have some inkling and understanding that I am owed this. I'm owed a great job, a trophy wife, and a house, a piece of land that I own. And from that, you know, that's what is owed to me if I do these things.
You know what's fucking great about that? Here's the thing. In the late 90s, it was the hollowness of that victory. It was Fight Club. Again, sorry to keep going back to this, but it's a guy who's like, your whole identity is you have IKEA, you have the stuff, you have the good job, and now you did it, and it fucking sucks, and it's hollow, and it's not masculinity, and it's hollow. The next generation doesn't have those things, and they're thinking, well, the things that didn't even make us happy have been stolen from us, so we need to find someone to blame to fight about that. And it's so easy to form an identity in reaction.
They didn't even get to disaffection.
They didn't even get to disaffection.
You didn't get to be General Smith. Exactly. You didn't get the Doc Martens. You didn't get to smoke the Marlboros without the without the filter.
Yes, 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 yes.
You didn't even get that shit. You got some tattoos and a fucking beard.
But there's something, if you can suspend your... And it's hard for people, it's hard for me. But when I can just look at something as an artistic act, I will tell you this, I haven't listened to Miles Davis since I read that from his biography, his autobiography, that he beat Cicely Tyson. I can't listen to his music.
Right.
I hear it in every note. I can't watch himself, although I think that Bill Cosby's himself is probably one of the best comedy albums of all time. I will never be able to listen to it again.
Yep.
And there are so many examples of that from like every corner. But I look at, you know, you look at somebody like Wes Anderson and his whole career and this movie and the context of all of them. And I really do hope it's not a jog away, but you know, Quentin Tarantino saying he's retiring, it hit me in a really weird way because I didn't want to retire on what's the fucking cabin bullshit?
Hateful Eight.
Which is a horrible movie. It's horrible. It's horrible. It is the worst movie he's ever made.
Oh my God. And we're going to spend another 2 hours talking about Hateful Eight.
Carry on. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like he's such an incredible
filmmaker.
An activist. I think what we've said this before to each other.
Yeah.
I believe that his career became about righting historical wrongs for cathartic healing. And then this movie comes along, you're like, what the fuck was this shit? And that was when, I don't know when it happened, his editor died.
She died in a heat wave. She went hiking a Runyon Canyon and died out there from hiking too hard.
That's why I always say, don't go hiking.
Don't ever hike.
White people, know what? I just finished reading this book about people who fake their own deaths.
Oh, really?
Playing dead. It's really interesting.
Okay.
Which now means you can't do it because
it's been covered.
I've told you about it.
Unless you do it well.
No, but you can't. But if you're a woman, the best way to fake your death is to go hiking.
Of course it is. Yeah.
Because more women go missing hiking. Wild. Everybody wants you to
disappear.
Know. But people all think, first thing most people say is drowning. Like, I'll go into the ocean. But actually, the way the tides work, bodies wash up. If your body doesn't wash up within 24 hours, they know it's some fucked up bullshit. You're lying. They just do. It just doesn't work that way. But if you're a woman, hike.
I just heard about a guy who's trying to fake his own death, and he was going to drown. So he had his car. He's going to park it by this bridge, and he was going to commit suicide, right?
No. It's in this book.
Is this the guy who got caught in the net?
Yes.
So he jumped off
and
got caught in the net.
They're fixing the bridge, and he didn't realize it.
Yeah.
And he had a guy set up to like take him back, waiting for him to take him back when he didn't fall in, or like when he came back out. But they put a net up to catch debris, and
he couldn't get it. He couldn't climb out of the net, and he hurt his leg because his leg fell through one of the holes. A very, very bad situation.
Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. She talks about him early on.
Let me come back. Something you were just saying, Angela, though, is that I really think is interesting. Two things. One is, we've obviously had a vast overabundance of representation from male white storytellers, especially in film. I mean, in all sorts of elements, but especially in film, in American film. However, what Travis and I talk a lot about on this is that the movies that seem to resonate the most with us resonate almost as journalism. They resonate as expression of your single reality, subjective self, and that you can always tell when something is true or when something is honest.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps what you are suggesting is that now, almost more than we have ever needed people to express and explore and examine themselves from a white male point of view, is right now, because that's fucking fracturing the entire country.
Exactly.
Hallelujah. Amen.
I really feel
tell it.
My family, I'm the only artist, if you will, although I'm uncomfortable with saying that, even though I shouldn't be. I know. I'm going to take myself on
an
artist date.
Own it.
I'm going to take myself on an artist date tomorrow.
Have some quality time with you and your artist self.
That it's hard to look at how we talk about things and what that means for how I see myself, but people don't
I think the fundamental, not fundamental, there's lots of issues, but here we all are. We're in this space together. We all got raised in the same culture. I have the same issues that you do. You have the same issues than I do, but you don't know that. I know all about you. You don't know about me. I could tell you anything about Kwanzaa right now. There's a solid chance you'd believe me. And I can't spell Kwanzaa. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't even fucking matter. You know, like, we talk about this all the time. But yet, is an important, there's so many things about this that are important.
Yes. You know, the thing I want to put in here is, there was a time in film where the religious iconography, the images, everything was there. What I think Wes Anderson did was he said, "Let me speak to the spirit."
Yes,
but from an spirit way.
It's innocent.
Without it being about religion.
I'm not trying to push an agenda.
But let's. I'm going to help you find. I'm going to take a look at this humanity in who we are. I'm sorry, I'm talking about.
No.
We're recording.
But that to me is what his filmmaking is about and who his characters are trying to be and where he's trying to be. That's the film he makes.
Mm.
And when I look at, you know, so when I'm watching the film, I'm watching on a couple of different levels. I'm looking at how the actors, the latitude the actors get, and in the playfulness, and you know, because we are from Second City in Chicago, and I can see people improvising a mile away.
Yeah.
I can see the back and forth and genuineness, and you know when you're not, you can't write that. That's not a script. There's an idea there.
They're brothers, like the same way that we're sisters, but better.
Yes, yes.
I mean, our part is
better. So you're watching it, but then you see, I wonder what happens when he gets all that material together.
I think he gets stuck in the set.
Yeah.
Although I love the set, I think he does get mired. I think you were talking about this in the intro. He gets mired in the minutia of the set and the design in a way that, although I love it from a purely, I love it perspective.
Visually.
Can I say something about that? When you guys said this earlier, it really caught my brain that Kaelin said this. He said he makes outdoor locations look like sets. I want to tell a quick story about David Blaine because I think it's relevant. So
it always is.
Yeah, it always comes back to David Blaine. So David Blaine's known as a magician, but has become increasingly disinterested in magic. And he uses it as a weird weapon. And this one effect is really smart. So there's an old classic effect where you put some fake putty on your arm and you shove a needle through it. It looks like it's going through your arm and you can pull it, tug it, looks like skin. And so what David Blaine does is he shows Ricky Gervais this trick. He's like, here's how it looks, you know. You put the putty on your arm and you shove it through. See how he does it, and Ricky Gervais does it on his own arm. He's like, cool, that's the effect. And just let me show you. It never transitions. He goes, yeah, so it looks like this, and then takes a needle and legitimately puts it through his bicep.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, does it. And he'd work to find a place where it wouldn't bleed or whatever. And he keeps going, see, look, it looks like it's really going through and there's no blood, you know, same as before. And he's doing...
He does almost this mantra thing where he's like, but look, see how it really looks.
Yeah, but
he's
look,
like, see
look,
how it looks.
Look.
He doesn't... Wow.
Put that microphone by your mouth.
I'm sorry. Wow.
Yeah. But so, what's interesting about it most people use fake things to look like magic.
Right.
And he's doing a real thing. Sorry, he's doing fake things to look like real.
Yeah.
He's doing a real thing to look fake.
Yes.
And it's really smart. And I haven't seen the magician do that before, where he's doing something real and acting like it's a fake trick.
Exactly.
And Wes Anderson...
The best hide in plain sight.
Well, Wes Anderson, by making a real location look like a set, is taking it to that next level of filmmaking or something. It's really, really a curious idea that I'm really intrigued by.
And you know it. Like, that's the thing. Is like, because... What you're I'll be very honest, Travis. I was not on board with you telling a David Blaine story.
Yeah.
I was like, you're derailing in a disgusting way.
But every time I start a story, Kaelin feels uninterested.
Like,
and every time I finish, though,
Travis,
he goes,
I'm going to cut this shit out.
So for the David Blaine story.
I know, mentally, I start folding my laundry.
I know what you're saying.
But this is how every story ends. Kaelin's not. You think after 71 episodes, you'd get over this weird thing?
No, it doesn't happen.
I know.
Kaelin still.
bitch still France, doesn't
same thing. Because every time I start a story, Kaelin's like not interested. And at the end, he goes, "Oh, that's really okay." I that.
It's true. It is true that it's every a time I will sometimes say that's the most interesting thing I've ever heard. I am rolling my eyes.
No, like, literally. No, trust me. Every time we do this podcast, Kaelin's like yawn. He's making like cut it out gestures. Like stop telling this dumb story. And the end is like
his own throat and his own eye.
At one time, he goes, "I started paying attention halfway through that story, and it's really interesting."
Here's the thing. Great. What I do is I make it about my achievement in understanding his point. That's why it's cool. Great. Is that's, yeah, that's my whole
story. What was my point there?
So, what I think is so interesting about that is that
the air conditioning is on.
Everybody knows.
No, we turned it off for the recording.
Is that everybody knows. Don't walk out. Watching the movie, you know that.
Yeah.
You can see it and you know that he has constructed reality to fit a fantasy.
Yeah.
And that feels like something. And that feels...
It feels new.
It feels new and it feels integral to the the film.
I think that's the thing we actually have in common. Moonlight?
Yeah.
You both?
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah, for sure. It did. Yeah.
Gorgeous, right? Like the kind of movie that you're like, it knocks the wind out of you.
Yeah.
And the last, the idea, and I think this is important for people to understand, that floating in water is a privilege. like you don't think of it that way. You think about like equal pay or voting rights acts or you know, the ability to protest, but there's the class situation. So many people never get the opportunity to just float in the water and have somebody and feel safe. Feeling safe is something you can't put a price on. You can't. And this is where I get some critiques, which is when you talk about Wes Anderson, you're talking about somebody who is very protected.
Yeah.
You know, he is a very protected person. Everybody in
his artistic vision is a protected vision.
Everything about it is protected. And I'm not, but I do appreciate what he does. I don't think he abuses it, but it is worth that. Acknowledge.
Oh my God, you are so right. And I mean, I felt this powerfully. I think I've talked about this on the show, is that I was reading some oral history of Pulp Fiction, and I know it always comes back to QT, but like what happened was when he was going to make, I'm saying that to be funny, but when he was going to make Reservoir Dogs, they just let him. And it was almost like everybody looked at each other and they were like, you know what? We don't want him to understand that there's a real world because we want him to do what he does.
That's right.
And we think that's worth the wager.
That is about developing an artist.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like what you said at the beginning is the exact same thing James L. Brooks said when he said, I'm going to let this guy figure his shit out.
And
that is something that continues to be applied principally or only to white males.
That's my only critique.
No, that is so fair. And he can be honest. He's allowed to be honest. But it's still kind of bullshit. And
well, it's hard because you can't, when I went to the University of Michigan, because I'm from Michigan, it's an in-state school for me. It's not. I actually didn't understand that people cared about it until I left Michigan.
Because
I was like, I totally know when I go here. And my mom, because I wanted to go out of state and we couldn't afford it. So my mom's like, no, you got to go in state. So that's the school you go to if you can. It's the best school in the state. So unequivocally. But I remember my sophomore year, first year of, in the East Quad. And which is a residential college also, which is really super cool. You're right on campus. It's a very cool dorm. But I was like on top of my shit. Like I applied in junior year and got in. Like I was ahead of the game, whatever. But like sophomore year, I applied to be an RA. And then, that was junior year. Sophomore year, I moved into a co-op. And there's a co-op system, I'm sure at many colleges, but at U of M. And the co-op system actually seems to service more foreign students than American students in terms of nationality, because it's, you go into this dorm, everybody's the same, it's a fixed price, you have chores. So, but I chose to go in the co-op system because I really wanted to be in a co-op because I was a hippie Afro-Saxon. And so I moved into a joint house, which is two houses that were joined, although yes, weed was a big part of it, but joint house. And everybody, you get a work assignment every week, 3 to 4 hours work assignment, every single person. And I was like doing dishes, and the president of the council came to me, and he was like, hey,
I want to talk to you about some other opportunities for work assignments. I was like, okay. I didn't know him. I'm like a sophomore, you know, junior. No, I was a sophomore. A sophomore. And he pulls me aside and says, why don't we have more black people in the co-ops? They're economically advantageous. You know, politically, you know, this is a place where people can live and not get lynched. You know, like, and there are a lot of dorms that it gets iffy.
Yeah.
You know, like, I had a lot of interactions on that campus, as large as it is. And I was like, I don't really know. He's like, oh, how about if your work assignment is you figure out and tell us what we need to do to get more minorities?
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So I'm, at that point, 18. And so I was like, okay. So I go around and talk to, and at that point, it's changed. My sister just told me recently. At that time, if you were black at probably anywhere, but the University of Michigan, you had to say hi to every black person. Mm-hmm. If you didn't say hi to every black person, you were going to get beat the fuck up.
Yeah.
So like, or, in some kind of way, right. Metaphorically or physically. But like, so you, hey. And my friends would be like, do you know that person? I'm like, no, they're black. Don't even. I don't have time. So like, I just have to do it. Hey, you know, so like, I did, I asked people and did everything I could. And then we came back from the meeting where I was supposed to present my results. And I'll never forget, he played a banjo. The guy who was the head of the co-op council.
That makes sense.
He'd been, I know, right? And he'd been like learning. Banjo is actually, it's very complicated.
It's very complicated. Very hard. I've tried.
And he had like those little pick things on like every finger. And yeah. I was like, I would hurt myself. I'd forget and do like scratch my head or something. So, and he was like, so what did you find out? And I said, and it's the truth. It's still the truth, which is, he's like, why aren't more minorities, particularly ethnic minorities, particularly black people, willing to be in co-ops? And I went, because there are no black people, particularly ethnic minorities, and black people who are willing to be in co-ops. And he went, I was like, no, I did just repeat what you said. Yeah. You know,
did that count as your work study? Did you still get the credit for doing it?
Let me tell you something. I didn't have to do any housework, which did piss off some people. But I was like, I actually did try.
Yeah.
Like, I interviewed everybody I could. And the reality is, if you want an environment that's diverse, you have to hire a diverse environment. It's not that complicated.
Right.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Because when I walk into a room and we feel a certain connection to each other, I want you with me. Yeah. But I have to acknowledge where some of that connection might come from.
Yeah, I don't.
Right. Yeah.
I don't want anybody who doesn't know the Black National Anthem. I mean, why would I come and introduce that to a co-op that doesn't have it? It's just a very weird feeling to have to.
We only know the first three lines. Let me be clear about that.
You sold it though so hard. I believed every second.
No,
of that.
But it's one of those things that like I've never seen my people look more like.
Yeah.
What the fuck? They all thought we were lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happens. You know, the reality is that. This is where you go, it makes me want to put my arms around Wes Anderson, because he doesn't have to have that perspective. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to put any people of color, because
he doesn't have to carry the burden of a larger man.
Yeah.
That's
because,
right.
Because the world, his world is so stark. It's so stark that, and there's so few characters in the first place, that what he says to me, which makes me respect him,
yeah.
is that in every film I think I've seen, there's been people of color.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and he seems to be saying, and this is not necessarily the best thing that you can say.
I'm just saying real quickly. Yeah. Unlike fucking Woody fucking Allen.
Unlike Woody Allen.
Oh, they got high fives. They got high fives.
Thank you.
Well,
I live in New York. I ain't never seen a fucking brown person in my fucking life.
Speaking of the Bill Cosby problem.
Playing
jazz. Yeah, right,
no,
right.
I'm glad you said that, because what the difference is, Wes Anderson seems to be saying, at the very least,
yes.
there are things I know I don't know.
Yes.
And well, and I will acknowledge that there are realities out there that I don't have any access to or ability to
and
access.
I think they all seem more sagacious than him. Like, all those characters, the minor characters, seem to know what's going on.
Well, they're living in the world. Yeah, they are real people.
They just go along with it because it's Tuesday and they get their check on Wednesday. Like, there's this, like, lack of enthusiasm.
And there is a feeling of, like, wow, what a beautiful thing. What a beautiful, simple, naive fantasy you were trying to project. And we kind of respect you and love you for it, but it doesn't... I watch these movies and I sense a great sadness, which is not in...
Because white men are lost.
That's how it feels. And I mean, like, in these films in particular, this point of view feels, I mean, we keep saying it, but it feels deeply disassociated from reality.
Well, when it's vulnerable, we keep coming back
to this. Vulnerable is a great word.
When it's vulnerable and when it's honest, you sense it and you feel it. And I do think that that white male vulnerability is, although rare, overrepresented.
Overrepresented. Yeah, absolutely.
And so, but we can sense, and we had this weird big debate about Boondock Saints. The question is, does its vulnerability and honesty in terms of its grossness and hatred make it valuable, and does it make it good in a certain level? And so that became an interesting conversation. But I do think that you have the sense about what is real. Oh, that person's talking about something that's real, as opposed to being something he's not. And a lot of that literary movement, a lot of that film movement is, I think, out of vogue a lot, yes. Because it feels so overrepresented.
Yeah.
And David Foster Wallace is a great kickback from this, of like, mm-hmm. that dude's honest about his experience, yeah. and it's nuanced, and it's crazy, and it's, you know, anal and strange and psychotic. But it's representative of a movement in a guy that we've become kind of sick of as a culture, yeah. because we hear so much about that.
We're
guy.
Sick of. I we do have to actually kind of wrap it up.
We haven't done the plot yet. We'll do the plot.
Forget about the plot. Who cares? Go watch Bottle Rocket. We're gonna do the plot. Just go watch it and then come back.
It's enjoyable. It's funny. It's cute. They're all so cute and sweet and lovable. So there's just nothing about it that will offend you if you are open to not being an asshole.
I don't want to forget two things. One, we started to talk about a moment ago, which is religion, which is that where the white male at least found a certain kind of comfort in American film history was in Catholicism or Christianity. Yeah. And this movie,
Identity.
You know, what Francis said earlier is it's very stark, is that this movie lacks that entirely.
Yes.
There is no representation of Christianity or religion at all. And that is part of their lostness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a filmmaker like Wes Anderson and Quentin Tarantino, but, you know, it's funny. It actually strikes me that Wes Anderson was first championed by Scorsese. He's one of the very first people to really celebrate him. And he's like Scorsese if you didn't have both the anxiety and the safety of religion. He doesn't have
an immigrant experience.
And he's not an immigrant. And he doesn't have that connection to the previous generation. He's just here in America. And he's just feeling stranded.
Well, that's why a lot of people.
Nothing to do with religion.
Well, no, but it is in that it's a lack of identity. Is that I think a lot of people who a lot of people equate the rise of atheism with this movement, not because one is correlated, not because one is caused by the other, but because when you don't have an identity to cling to, you search for identity in other places. Mm, a lot of the people who would become priests or devout religious people, or who would become Jehovah's Witnesses, don't have that anymore because they're taught in a young age to be a secular humanist or whatever the fuck it is, or that religion is not cool, and they become alt-right, they become other things,
and then,
because that's a different identity they have to wear.
Taught secular humanists. Yeah, they're taught anything. Yeah.
I'll say this. Trump is a new religion.
Yeah, that's right. Totally. Well, it's an identity.
Bingo. That's exactly where I was going.
He's an old religion that's been slightly new packaged.
But it's
nothing new. These people have never had a new message.
But you've taken out the concept of God, and that, you know, this idea that what you said, Angela, which is that we do need to look at this and study it. It's newly relevant in the sense that white American males who continue to run the country do not, or in some ways, and have a massive influence, do not have that fallback anymore, safety. And so they are looking for new gods. I mean, they're looking for new things.
Hallelujah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's and suddenly the thing that has been so desperately overrepresented is completely vital. We just need to understand it and crack it and examine it. And so it's a very funny time where there's this whole shifting identity of the country, but it comes back to this one fucking ugly core.
Human truths. There are things that we can all enjoy and love about each other.
We can all learn about each other.
Who doesn't know what it's like to? Well, don't kill yourself if this hasn't happened for you, but because it will happen. There's the inexpressible, ineffable joy of liking someone and having them like you back. On a very, if we take everything else away, there are human experiences that transcend everything. Love beyond attraction, connection beyond sex, and a willingness to be daring and to just jump in.
Yeah.
These are qualities I think that a lot of people would value and do value, and but we don't have the opportunity to share that experience. We
totally,
that's correct.
And it's not
tribalism and identity.
Yeah.
But it's not, and I don't mean to be really really fucking new agey about this, but like, but that there's,
I got a crystal in my pussy.
Okay, good. But that these, I see these guys, these horrible, horrible, misguided and lost guys who are beating people and caught and burning shit and doing all this nonsense in Virginia. And I think, like, I don't know what degree empathy needs to enter into it, but like they do need to have their story told, and they do need to be processed. Mm-hmm. Like, they are unprocessed white Americans, and there's been no, they don't know that. And they, and they, and I don't mean that as like they're victims on any level.
No, but they were, they're told that they're superior, yet they're, they can't keep,
but this is what drives,
you know, it doesn't work.
To back to you, what you always say is that there are people who need to work some shit out.
That's right. They do.
And I look and I look at Bottle Rocket, and I mean, I this is so cute, I can't believe it. But like, that character, this guy who's creating an alternate fantasy reality for himself and failing and going down the drain is all those guys.
He could become that instantly. And here's the thing, is that people always tell me they're so shocked when they look at this, the Christian right, and they go, but they're not acting like Jesus. This is the opposite of Jesus. And I'm like, that should tell you everything you have to know.
Exactly.
Because it's never about Jesus. It's about who they say they are when they say they're Christian right.
Yeah,
that's the thing that matters. And with whatever you do, it, as long as you do as a group, you're still part of the group. It doesn't matter the action you take. It matters who you're with when you take it.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes a lot of the fucking
definition.
So you're
saying the people that you truck with.
Yeah.
Hello.
The people you associate with.
Hello.
Yeah.
Help create your identity.
Which is, by the way, the plot of Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut.
There you go. Just when when people are able to rally a lot of this country behind something like cancel or eliminate the death tax, as if, how many people in this country actually have somebody die in their family with anything but
75
bills?
75
you know what I mean?
people 75 people.
People, but they brand it so perfectly, right. Like, death tax is wrong. I'm like, motherfucker, your double wide is going for foreclosure.
Don't,
what are you talking about? You don't have shit. And it's just, you look around at people, and I get it. I really do get it. Like, I feel like, but we get it. I get that you look around the world, and you were sold some bullshit, you know? And it's hard. And in the absence of organizations that can take that energy and give you information, what do?
You know what's crazy? And listen, just hit the last tier, the last leg of the political spectrum, because we hit everything else politics here.
I think we've made it clear that Bottle Rocket is about the resistance.
I agree.
I don't know.
I agree. Why can't people see that?
Angela Davis and all these motherfuckers didn't talk about it.
It's so clear.
Even though it hadn't happened
yet,
they should have known. 20
years ahead of his time.
What
Travis, they should have known.
What boggles my mind is that we, you know, all we've been looking for since 55, when Kurt Vonnegut started writing and stuff, since then we've been looking for what's an external threat. What's an external threat we can unify behind? And then starting in the 80s, we get one. We get a real one that's global climate change, and we go, oh, we could unite around this. And then shit falls apart, which is so ironic to me that the human race for its entire existence has been searching for one thing to unite against that's a common White Walker fucking thread, right?
Francis.
What's coming against the wall, across the wall? We get it, and they're like, fuck it.
It's Francis, and I will tell you why. And you're going to agree with me.
I'm sure.
In the abstract. Yeah, it's not you specifically.
Maybe not the specific.
I have a new roommate. She has a dog. She got lied to about how old it is. Because we look at the teeth, I'm like, dude, there's like baby teeth.
Don't look a gift dog in the teeth.
That's what I'm saying. The dog that she was told was a year old, I think it was when she got it, was more like 3 to 5 months old. Mm-hmm. But in any case, it's a very sweet dog. But he would not let me near him for the first 2 weeks they were in the apartment. Wouldn't let me growl, like, not just like, but like, I'm going to fucking eat your face growl. And I have a German Shepherd. A German Shepherd mix. It's like 85 to 95 pounds. And this dog is like 4. And like, my dog was scared. And so I was like, he won't let anybody be around. Francis comes over, sits down. The dog checks Francis. Now, Francis is loving. She exudes, as I know that you will swear to me now.
Yes, I will swear.
A loving, genuinely, I'm not going
to
kill you presence. I'm not sure I do. But the point is, he looked at you, he looked at me, and he jumped in my lap.
Wow.
So that was the common enemy.
What? That's what like, I'm saying, dude. I was like, I was like, Francis, he won't even let he wouldn't let me give him a treat. He wouldn't let me give a treat. I put bacon, a slab of bacon for a dog. That is like the holy grail of like, fuck yeah. I put bacon in my hand and he wouldn't come near it. He would growl at me like he was going to rip off my face. Francis comes over and he looked at her, looked at me, and he jumped in my lap.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was like, all we need now for you, for him to love you, is another stranger.
All right, let's find the stranger.
Needs. That's what America needs.
That's what we all wish.
I'm going to let our common enemy.
Before we do this, where can we follow you? Where can we, what do you want to, tell us some plug stuff.
You can Frangela Duo.
You can listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it's called The Final Word.
Or an Omni.fm podcast, same deal.
Yes, and it's a political podcast.
And on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter,
Snapchat.
We're not as successful at, but we try.
Frangela Duo. I will follow you on Snapchat. I want to see what the fuck you do on Snapchat.
Hard. I bet it's weird. I try really hard, but what you're going to get is a lot of like Francis's thigh.
Yeah, I got to see
the side of a wall. Like, I really Inside have not pockets. Mastered the Snapchat.
By the way, congrats on the podcast. If you guys please subscribe to it. It's awesome. And congrats on the success of it.
Can I just say, like, what a ridiculous pleasure it was to have you guys on there watching this hilarious movie?
We could do it anytime. We could do that, which is lovely, and maybe not for some people, but for
next time let's do something less racially charged than Bottle Rocket. It's too racially charged. We got too far. Let's do something a little blander, more white. You know, just
Bottle Rocket.
Obviously, this was
Bottle
too.
Bottle Rocket. It's pretty much the birth of a nation. Of It really is.
Yeah, Wes Riefenstahl. Great. All right.
Please select our next film.
Go deep. Go deep. Get to the white meat, please.
Dude, I remember.
Next week,
no, you read it
Travis
up.
And I will be watching and dissecting.
Wait.
The film called
Rocky Five. That's your shit.
Are you kidding? Wait, why?
Whoa. All right. Maybe. Well, first of all, you look mad. You look angry.
Francis, back me.
Rocky Five is the one where he's brain
it's
damage.
The one that we ignore. It's the Godfather 3. Rocky 5 is the one that I refuse to acknowledge.
Yes, you do.
There is nobody besides Rocky, maybe, and he's punch drunk. I'm not sure. Who knows? That is my life. In fact,
just
yesterday, motherfucking day, I was at Martha's Vineyard, as any good Afro-Saxon would be this week, because the Obamas were there. And one of my favorite places on the planet is the Flying Horses, which you have been to. And her daughter, Francis, my goddaughter, has been on. Francis' daughter. My goddaughter, her daughter. And they, you know, it's the oldest carousel in the country. You grab rings.
Yeah.
That's where you get the brass ring.
Oh, well, I've seen the text ring. Right.
So I win often because I'm good. But the point is that Rocky for me is like a whole philosophy. So I got two rings. I bought two because you can buy them. The ones aren't in play. And to give just to two friends of mine. And this is the thing about the ring. When you get the breast ring, do you know what you win?
Mm-mm.
Another turn.
Whoa.
Best metaphor for life ever.
I love it. That's it.
You don't win anything other than the chance to try again.
You know what? Some people don't even win the chance to try again.
But they don't walk away. Oh. This is the thing that's amazing about it. Nobody walks off that ride crying. Nobody walks off that ride feeling that they were wronged or they didn't get a chance. Nobody. I'm talking to 2-year-olds, 8-year-olds. And let me tell you, the ride I was on just now, there was a controversy about my win. It's not worth discussing.
No, I mean, I'm sure it's bullshit.
About win, which Francis knows because I called her. I was like, this is some bullshit. I won. I got the
record. And then she screamed Ferguson.
Yeah.
And I went, Ferguson, hashtag Ferguson. But the reality is that people, you know, you get off that ride if you quote unquote lose and you get back in line. I've never seen anyone get off that ride and be pissed and walk out. You get back in line and try again. It's the perfect metaphor.
And Rocky Five is the controversial failure of the Rocky franchise.
Where you say maybe you should have killed yourself. Maybe.
But then comes Rocky Balboa, comes Creed, and that shit
Let me tell you
something
you
itself.
Already know. Life ain't nothing. Ain't always kittens and rainbows. I'm saying that monologue is the shit, and I just wrote it. You know, you've received this letter. I wrote it to this friend of mine where I was like, here's a brass ring for the Flying Horses. And as my favorite philosopher, Rocky Balboa, says, it ain't how hard a punch you can throw or, make. It's how hard a punch you can take and keep moving forward.
Keep getting and get up and
because that's how winning is done.
So here's a brass ring from from Martha's Vineyard.
Exactly, sure. Which has a very actually, if you look at radical history about black people, it's one of the few places that black people could own property.
We're gonna make the Rocky Five conversation pretty much something. Racially.
Yep. This whole Rock podcast is now racially charged.
Is the movie where I go, I didn't happen. But 1-4 and Balboa and Creed are fucking.
But that's
amazing.
Why we must watch 5, that's and right. That's why we're gonna get deep into it
it's
next
the same
week.
With Human Centipede, you gotta watch 1 to watch 2.
Yeah,
because 2 is brilliant.
2 is brilliant.
I'm
2 is a tour de force.
Side note: our friend scored Human Centipede 2 and had just had his first child while he was scoring it. And that movie's about 90% music and hit the, you know, it's a lot of score. And he sat there with his child, rocking his child with one hand and scoring frame by frame Human Centipede 2.
I will go to the mat with you guys on Human Centipede 2 as a quality piece of art. I'm
yes,
fucking
it's
into
quality.
It.
It's quality.
It is
quality.
You know
what? After this podcast is over, the
let's fire that shit up.
Human Centipede 2 has been denied its birthright.
It is an amazing movie. It is brilliant.
3 is
four to
bullshit.
Fucking 4.
3 is some bullshit. You have to watch 1 to get 2, but 2 is amazing.
Yep,
it's
yep,
perfection.
Yep, yep.
We're going to talk about
it. A diamond in a cave of shitty coal. It is amazing.
Well, we're going to want to talk about all this next week.
Does your favorite movie suck?